Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's December 27, 2013. You're listening to the best poker cast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Stinky Long.
It's a good thing we don't have Smellocast or whatever.
Exactly. I know you got stuff to do. You called me on my walk and said, hey, let's get to this. I didn't even know you got up that early. I thought somebody stole your phone. And I'm like, all right, no. Hey, as soon as I get back home from my walk, we'll be doing it. So here I am, sweating for you. Sweating to the oldies.
Well, it is our last show of the year, so it's appropriate that you stink because it's been a long year. We don't want you sitting in your filth any longer than you have to, so let's get right to it. Republicans love online poker!
You know, isn't this crazy? Actually, it's not crazy. I mean, we've been saying this forever, is that when it comes to the gaming and poker, party distinctions mean absolutely nothing. Or at least it seemed like it to me, because, you know, you have the Republicans who, you know, don't like any kind of regulation at all, usually. And then you have the liberals who are Democrats who... I lost my train of thought of what they do, but in some way they like it. I saw this poll, and admittedly it's from a libertarian magazine named Reason. So, you know, take that prism with a grain of salt, if you will. But says that 65% of Americans support online poker. That's very nice, right? Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, probably slightly surprising to me, the most likely to support it are Republicans, the young, the rich, and the college-educated.
Wow. I don't know what to think about this. What is it they're saying, like, when they say Republicans, though? Are they talking about Republicans overall, or are they talking about, like, young, rich?
It was somebody who, you know, when they to the poll, they identified themselves as the options that they were given when the pollsters asked them were Democrat, independent-leaning Democrat, independent-leaning Republican, or Republican. And 66% of Republicans said they should government should allow prohibit.
This is what happens when Scott doesn't shower. He doesn't wash his brain. His brain needs to be washed before he can come on the show. We'll note this for future episodes.
66% of those that identified themselves as Republicans are in favor of government allowing to play online poker. 75% of those are independent, that lean Republican, say that, which is probably some of the libertarians as well there. Only 58% of the Democrats do, but again, that's 58%.
Right.
So
more than half. Yeah, that's right. And the one other thing about it too is the Wall Street Journal had reported within this story too that by 2020, online gambling will generate the same revenue as Vegas and Atlantic City combined, $9.3 billion. Now, I know that's what scares most of these, you know, brick and mortar places, but as long as they're getting their piece of the pie, then they're still sort of getting the same amount of money. It's just in different ways, but that's just huge. And how could someone who's trying to find money for their country see that and not say, this is a game of skill, we're gonna get $9.3 billion from it, let's do this?
Yeah.
God, Reason magazine, it should be a rational magazine. See what those people say.
Absolutely no surprise to me that the younger folks, 70% of those who are 35 or younger are younger than 35, and 70% of those are 35 to 55 allow it. So, I mean, obviously, this is as much a technology thing as it is a poker question, I think.
You're
and
probably right.
The fact that, you know, people grew up on computers and don't really worry about this hack hacker stuff and this crazy stuff that, you know, mom calls me after watching the 6 o'clock news every night about are more likely to support. And then I guess I was a little surprised by the education. 76% of college graduates and 73% of folks that have postgraduate degrees favorite, only 55% with high school or less. And I didn't really think that this was an educational issue, but I guess it is. I guess maybe, I guess what you could say about that is folks that have more education probably understand, again, the same thing, that these concerns that people have about hacking and theft and everything are well-intentioned, but overblown.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that could be it. But I was just glad to see that there's more stuff in our favor. That if it's true, I mean, obviously they did their polls and everything, but, you know, who knows what the old, you know, party, you know, is doing and what kind of pull they have there. But generally, if you're getting the people that you think are opposed to it now on your side, you know, something's going to happen sooner or later.
And I think the other important thing is that every one of these categories, which is all those party designations that I mentioned, the 3 age groups, 4 income groups, and 4 education groups, the lowest percentage that said that they would allow or in favor of allowing online poker, 55%.
So it's still much more than half.
Yes.
So the majority is there. I mean, it's not an overwhelming two-thirds majority or something like that, which a lot of stuff is required for passing, but still, it's more people than not say we should do it.
Yeah, and again, this is one poll, and it's from a libertarian magazine, so, you know, you don't want to pin too much policy on that, but I think it kind of supports some of the other looser, smaller polls that I've seen. And eventually, I mean, really, the ultimate take out of this is we have a very vocal minority, which is usually how politics is done in this country, very vocal minority that's making the opposition seem bigger than it really is.
Right.
And I think it's really up to those of us that aren't against it to find a way to drown out that, or at least let that opposition be weighed in the proper weight, and not like get too much more credit than they deserve.
No, absolutely. I just like the positive part of this. I'm just so tired of negative news towards stuff like this. So. Speaking of positive, we haven't heard from Pizza Boy in a long time. Pizza Boy called in this week, and I'm happy to say that it was from a subject that I brought up in the past, Courchevel. Let's hear what he has to say.
Hey, Scott, Chris, it's Charlie. Just wanted to chime in on your podcast last week about Courchevel. Great game, Scott. You're right. When you were missed a good game that night, I guess, and also, that is actually a weekly game that's still going on, and the pots get pretty big pretty quickly. I mean, they're easily $1,000 pots, 3-4 people in a hand sometimes, where people are getting quartered. And, it's a pretty sick game. But we also have introduced it into our rotation, our no-limit cash game, 1-2 game. We'll have a second button. That'll be the Porsche button. And then every rotation, once around, we'll play a hand at Porsche. But it's a fun game, great game. Next time Scott, you're in town, we'll definitely stop by and play that game. And Chris, if you're around, come by as well. Anyways, take care, guys. Love the show. Later.
Yeah, I knew he would call in about that. He was stoked about that game. Again, I feel bad I couldn't go.
Yeah, and I feel bad that you couldn't go too, because I would have liked to have seen you lose a couple of grand.
And I know I would have. So part of me is not upset that I was tired that night.
But
that's a big game.
It is. It's exactly what we were sort of predicting. That it would be, you know, the minute you get 5 cards and you get to see a card, all hell breaks loose, baby. So maybe we shouldn't call it in our game. I don't know. But, I mean, it's so good that these guys have a whole night dedicated to it. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
No, you know, and Faso is always saying, hey, you know, I would play if you wanted to have just stud 8 all night or just limit hold'em. If that's what you wanted to do, I would do it. So, I mean, I think that I would consider something like that, you know, on all
night.
Yeah,
if we played more often than we did, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that would be fun to have a theme night where you just get one game and really drill down in it rather than, you know, 6-8 hands of it and switch to something completely different.
Exactly.
Or something subtly different like PLO to PLO.
Shut up.
Or the other way around.
I mean, we kind of did that before when we just played No Limit Hold'em Sit and Goes. So
yeah,
we sort of did that, but that was because we had a smaller variety of people there and whatever, but yeah, that seems pretty cool. Of course, you better bring a huge bankroll if you're going to play Courchevel all night.
I think it's going to be, hey, show up at 11 p.m., we'll play till midnight.
Play till midnight, bring $6,000. Playing 50 cent a dollar. You can rebuy. Absolutely crazy. All right, our listener spotlight. Each week we spotlight a listener who called our hotline, just like Turley did, at 813-448-1120 or emailed us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we'll send them something fantastic. This comes from RC... Oh, no, RS... I don't know, is it R Slots or is it RS Clots?
I always call them RC Slots, but you're right. It's RS Clots.
Yeah, so I guess it's RS Clots.
One of those little things where you just... it's a podcast, a gaming podcast, and you're like, oh, it's got to be Slots, right? But it's not. You're right. It's, mine plays games on it.
Can't you just email us and say, hi, my name's Joe? I mean, we would, you know, the next segment we're going to say it's Nick. You know, this one we could say it's Joe, but we got to come up with RS Clots or RS Clots or, I mean, you know, RSC Lots. I mean, there's a lot of things we could say and get, they just like us to be wrong. I think that's what it is.
So he says. RSC Lots. That would be a hard one.
He wants to know, is there a perfect tournament structure for amateur and pros alike? Where you can get enough play and not have one that lasts 3 weeks at the same time. I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I initially wrote back to him that you never want to say no. But I'm sure there's something out there that could work, right? But initially I wrote back saying, yeah, good luck with that. Because the problem is that most amateurs want to get in and out at night. Or don't want to play really long, and pros want to have like 5 hour levels if they could, you know.
Exactly.
And those two things just don't mesh. Now, since I responded to him, I will say that I've had a lot of discussions with our good friend Ben Irwin. He's the director of poker operations up at Thunder Valley Casino Resort, and specifically about our Andy Up World Championship next year. And he is really stoked about trying to put together. The most fantastic 1650 buy-in structure out there. And a lot of our discussions have been, you know, me giving him from the amateur or the recreational player point of view, because that's who I hang out with and who I talk to the most. And obviously he gets a lot of feedback from pros and trying to mesh the two. And I don't want to say we solved it, but I'm going to be really interested to see how this main event goes next August because... you know, he was really big on giving folks a lot of chips, so they're going to start with 50,000 units, which is almost unheard of these days, and start out with, I believe, 40-minute levels. It might have been 30. We were deciding between 30 and 40, and then ending with 60-minute levels. So the idea is to let those folks that are recreational players get a lot of chips to start with, and a fairly decent structure, so it'll be the initial tournament, there's enough play, but it will go quickly, and then at the end, let the pros have longer levels where they can really play poker when it matters, you know, and particularly in that tournament too, with re-entries through the first, I believe, six levels or something like that, you could do a lot of re-entries if you get knocked out. So I'm not going to say that's the perfect structure, but I think that's we're getting pretty close to something that's going to work for two folks, and that's going to end up being a three-day tournament with 300 players. Obviously, if you get more, then it's a little different. But that's not a bad time commitment, I think, for folks. If you come back for the day two, I believe you're in the money, and then the day three, you're just come back for the final table. So really, it's a two-day tournament for everybody, but the really successful players in the tournament. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think the other problem, too, is what's an amateur and what's a pro? I mean, you watch Twitter, and, you know, you have pros fighting over structure. Oh, yeah. I love the structure, but I hate the structure. Yeah. And then, you know, you talk to the folks in your local poker room, oh, I love this tournament, but I hate this tournament.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like going back to the Republican Democrat in this reason poll. I mean, it doesn't really matter so much. It's individual people and what they think is a good structure.
It's funny you say that because I've actually been doing a lot of research lately on debating and just, you know, just sort of dip my pool, tip my toe into that pool kind of thing just to see. And one of the major things that they always do when they first start a debate is they'll say, well, you need to define your X. So In our case here, like you said, you have to define what an amateur is because I think we kind of know what a pro is. I don't think we have to really define a pro. We think a pro is somebody who plays poker for a living and it's their sole income. And so these are the type of people that want to play poker for a long period of time because they feel like they're professional. And if they're given enough time against an amateur, they will get all your chips. That's how they feel. That's how they approach the game, that kind of thing. But when you're looking at an amateur, you know, there is a huge spectrum there that covers anybody who just gets out of work at 5 and wants to be home by 9 and play an entire tournament. And then there's people who are like, you know what, I can take a weekend off and I want to be able to pony up 1675 and play for 3 days. So that's the side of the spectrum that's very difficult to appease. I mean, like you said, there are pros who argue within pros about structures. And then again, those pros are, there are some pros who want to enter only $10,000 buy-ins, and they're going to argue with the guys who make a living on $1,100 buy-ins. So,
right.
But it really, you're right, it absolutely is the definition of those two terms that you'd have to really come up with, even if it was a consensus on each one, and then say, okay, now let's try to find a structure to make those two terms happy. That's how difficult this would be. But you're right, I think if you can, as an amateur, put aside 3 days, knowing that if you made it to the end, it would take you 3 days, then a structure like the one that we're putting together for our World Championship is something that's going to be hard to complain about.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, too, is that I want to go back to kind of what Channel Jody Russell here, because we have Call the Floor coming up here a little bit too. I know what R.S. Klotz is saying is that he wants a tournament where we can get a maximum amount of people outside of like the World Series, where everybody plays just because it's the World Series.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is some responsibility that players need to take to understand that there's no requirement for any poker room to give you a great structure. Obviously, the ones that do are the ones that are going to get the good business. But as a player, I think you need to learn how to adjust to playing different structures. You know, you need to be able to go into that $60 nightly in your favorite poker room that's designed to be a four-hour tournament and figure out how to win that based off that structure. And at the same time, you need to be able to get on a plane, go across the country to a circuit event or a big buy-in event, and know how to win in that structure. Obviously, you know the other factors involved, but I think the sitting around waiting for a good structure, I think, costs both recreational players and pros some money, because part of poker is understanding all the factors that go into it and being able to read a structure and not say, hey, this is crappy, but saying, hey, this is how I need to play to win in this structure.
Right. When somebody says something to you like, well, if we were playing real poker, you never would have called there, then they're the one who's the mistake. They're the ones that aren't adjusting properly, and it's just projecting their own defeat on you, and that's not right. So same thing with this. You know, you really need to adjust. So to answer his question, really, no. I don't think that you can actually find the perfect anything, and especially in poker. Just like when they say, what do I do in this situation when I'm under the gun with aces and I got five guys behind me, wait to act, or whatever. It always says, it depends. And just like this, yeah, there are structures that we think can please the masses, and we're trying to strive for that in ours. But no, I don't think there is a perfect structure. There's just no way to have one.
All right, well, it's time for Call the Floor. If you find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and not sure what the proper ruling should have been, email us at podcast@antiepmagazine.com, and we'll have our veteran poker room manager, Jody Russell, tell you how he would have ruled. This week comes from Nick from Lincoln, California. So I was playing in a $425 buy-in tournament when this situation came up. We're heads up on the river, and my opponent makes a bet of $1,500. I have $5,600 left, including a 5,000-unit chip. I didn't have enough small chips to toss in a complete call, so in an attempt to prevent confusion by tossing in my 5,000-unit chip, I just verbalized call as I table my hand directly in front of me face up. The other player must not have heard me and asked the dealer if I folded. The dealer silently shakes his head yes, and the other player tosses his cards into the muck face down. At the same time, the dealer grabbed my hand, mucked it, and pushed the pot to the other player. I asked the dealer why he's pushing the pot the wrong way, as I believe the other player mucked. Tournament director admits it was a dealer mistake, but awards my opponent the pot. They gave two reasons for this decision. First, the pot was pushed to the other player and cannot be taken back, even though the chips were still well in front of his other stack chips and easily identified. And secondly, they said because I hadn't actually put in the 1500 that I didn't have a case, even though I said call and tabled my hand immediately. Isn't my verbal call binding?
All right. Jody says, in a situation where the dealer doesn't hear the verbal action, it is up to the floor person to decide if the action was actually verbalized. If this floor person could not verify you made the verbal declaration by speaking with the dealer and the players around you, the decision not to award you the pot was correct in my mind. If he was convinced you did verbalize your action, then I disagree with the reasons he gave you. It doesn't matter where the pot has been pushed. If the other player already mixed the pot with his chips, the floor should have reconstructed the pot with the dealer and awarded you the proper amount of chips. That's pretty clear cut.
Yeah, I think this was a biff on this tournament director's part. Obviously, it was a huge biff on the dealer. But, just to say, hey, I mean, you had the last hand, too. That was the other thing, you know? I mean, there's just so many reasons that I can't... You know, part of the problem with all this call the floor is that sometimes you're in a really can't-win situation, right? Or things are just so messed up that you get to make the best call. Here, there's so many reasons not to make the decision that was, in my mind, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We had the last cards, you know? Obviously, we didn't put that bet in, so that's kind of the crux of it. But we had the last cards. And a lot of things, a lot of decisions that will go down the wrong way because a person has the last cards, right?
That's right.
And this is a situation where it sounds like, obviously from Nick's point of view, because he's the one that sent it in, that having last cards would have made this the right solution.
And the other part, too, about saying that the chips, you know, you can't give them the pot because we already pushed the pot the other way. What does that mean? Then why do we ever call a floor?
Right, you know? Well, yeah.
You know what I mean? Okay, well, no, hey, sorry, the chips are already in there. Can't call the call a floor because he's already got the chips. So even if we could rule in your favor, we can never, ever reconstruct this. No, of course you could. So there, it's just, that really doesn't sound right to me. It doesn't sound right. But, you know, hey, you know, we're not there either, and we're getting it from one side. So you have to always just say, hey, if this is exactly the way it happened, then this is what we think should have happened. And that's really all you can do.
Yeah, and I hate to put this on Nick, because I'm not going to put it on Nick. But, I mean, again, I like to take these opportunities to remind people what they can do to prevent it. And one thing that I do, I mean, again, I'm a pretty quiet, mild-mannered player at the table. But when I see a dealer grab my cards before he or she has pushed me the pot, I go ballistic.
Ballistic.
I'm like, I'll slap my hand on this card. I'm like, what are you doing? And even if it embarrasses me at times when I don't know what's going on, I'm fine with that because this is a situation where it really hurts because the dealer needs to push you the pot before they take their cards. And obviously some of those situations where you're all in before the boards run out and they move the cards, it's a little tougher to maybe to reach in there and grab your cards when they mess it up, but I need to, I'm going to be very vocal very quickly if I see the dealer messing with my cards before I've got the chips in front of me that I believe I'm supposed to have. So absolutely not Nick's fault at all. I'm not saying that. I'm just trying to, you know, use these situations to remind people what they can do to help prevent somebody else's mistake from becoming their mistake.
Yes.
That's exactly what happened here. I mean, Nick got screwed here from somebody else, and but I'm wondering if he was able to slap his hand down this card and hold on to him, whether that would have changed anything.
I never, ever, ever let go of my cards until the pot is mine. I literally keep my hand on the cards between the felt and my, the cards between my hand and the felt at all times, and I hold them until the pot is coming my way, and then I push the cards around the pot. And that's literally how I do every single pot when I'm playing cash or tournaments, whatever. If I'm in a hand and that pot is mine, or I have a chance at that pot, those cards are not going anywhere until it's determined that it's mine and the money's coming my way. You know, that's just the way I am. I'm not anal about it. It's just you need to be safe. You need to cover yourself, protect yourself, because there are going to be human errors that are going to keep you from winning a pot once in a while. So if your hands are on those cards, you know, you will not give up your hand until you have to. So. Hey, you know what? We get to it's the end of the year, so of course we have to finish in O'Malley's. It would be kind of weird to straddle the new year, you know, from old to new. Who knows what could have happened in that from 2013 to 2014? It's such a long time. So I'm very excited we get to finish, and we finish on a good note, a 1-2 no limit cash game hand. So here we go. Let's refresh our memories with part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em cash game. We're playing with some action junkies today, but they love to float. Furthermore, when they do float, they tend to play a bit timidly. We're up about $100 as we sit with a round 3. It's a full table. The under-the-gun folds, plus 1 folds, plus 2 folds. The MP raises it to $8. MP1 folds, hijack folds, cutoff folds, and we're on the button with the King of Clubs, Queen of Hearts. Now, this MP is a good player, but is impatient and extremely streaky. He's about even with 200 sitting in front of him. The problem is, we've seen him raise preflop with big hands as well as suited connectors and suited gappers. We're not exactly sure where we stand here, so we go in with a plan. We're going to call, and since we have position, proceed with caution. Basically, we're going to play the player. The blinds fold, and with about $20 in the pot, the flop comes the ace of spades, nine of hearts, tray of clubs. A total miss. But our player checks. This check stinks, especially since this guy loves to trap. But we really don't think that's what he's doing here. Nevertheless, we proceed with caution and check. The turn is the king of spades, and once again, our opponent checks. Okay, there's no way an ace or better is checking this turn. We make it $15 to go. The MP wastes little time in calling. The river is the 10 of diamonds. All of a sudden, the MP wakes up and makes a $35 bet into this $50 pot. What's our move?
I'm going to go ahead and disagree with O'Malley when he said there's no way our opponent would check that turn with an ace. Especially, I think, if our opponent thinks that that's exactly what we think. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but I know plenty of players who would check a big ace or more on that flop and turn, hoping to induce a bet from an opponent who misreads the checks as weakness. So when we find ourselves on the river with second pair, an opponent who finally wakes up, the river completes a straight, several two pair hands, and even a set of tens that would have played this hand exactly as our opponent has. It's also possible that he has the same or a weaker king and is playing mind games with this river bet. But I think that seems very risky to me. So I think we just got outplayed here, and I'm going to fold.
See, now, it's so awesome because we're going to end the year with me and you just totally at odds with each other. I'm going to sit here and just rip your... No, I guess I can't. I can't do that. I'm sorry. You really hit it on the head there. I can't. I really wish we could argue on the last, O'Malley of the year. It sucks when we agree.
We've got a hand of the week we can argue about.
All right, maybe we will. I don't know if we will, but at least O'Malley's move, But you're right here. When someone raises preflop and then an ace comes and they don't bet, it is fishy. But, if they had pocket kings or pocket tens, that's exactly how they would play it. So I'm still behind. No matter what, I'm still behind. If there are hands out there that beat me here, and it just seems to me that there are people who would check things. It could be fishy, but they still would check taking control of this hand. So I agree with you. I think we're outplayed. Not outplayed, but I think we're, behind here, and we need to fold. And it's not that really that big of a pot. So I'm not sure it's worth that for the information.
I'll clarify about what I meant by outplay. I think, O'Malley's making assumptions that I don't think he should be. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're making assumptions that you shouldn't be, I think that's where you get outplayed. If our opponent is making those kind of moves, knowing we're that kind of player that will make those kind of assumptions. So I'm making a lot of assumptions and saying that O'Malley might have got outplayed there, but that's what I'm thinking. I mean, if you play with people enough, you know how they think, and that's part of poker, right? So, I mean, our home game, we make all kinds of moves that we wouldn't make at a 1-2 no limit table because we know each other and we know how each other thinks. So I think that's probably the case here.
Fair enough. All right, let's see what happens.
Hello again. Could this be a slow-played ace? Perhaps it's a set that's trapping? The only real draw that got there was Queen-Jack, and I really can't put this player on that hand. So, it's either some kind of trap, or it's complete air. What could it be? Our curiosity gets the better of us, and we make the call. Yes, with only second pair. Our opponent turns over a suited 10-9 and takes in the pot, much to our disgust. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, be careful when you play against floaters. If you're not cautious, you could end up getting blindsided. I hope to see you on the film.
Hey, know, a second pair is always a hard call to make, I think. In the absence of more information, exactly like the situation we found ourselves in here, I always like to remind folks that another hand is just a minute away, and wait for it. You know, as you said before, it's not a huge pot here. You know, I don't want to give up a lot of little pots because that adds up. But when we're really put to a test, and it's cash, you know, it's not a tournament. You know, let's let it go and then wait to the better spot because we're going to be in a better spot at some point.
Sure. And you know what? That wasn't exactly the hand I put him on, but that doesn't really matter because the action, the way it came down there, made me feel like we were behind. It just really did. And that's what's most important is if you have a feeling that you're behind, that just there's no way he could be betting this with a worse hand than ours, then it's okay to let it go. And if you're wrong, you have to be wrong occasionally. But like we talked about, you know, okay, so you have to call 35 to win 85. Yeah, okay, but it sounds like if this guy really wanted you out, he would have bet a lot more than that.
Yeah, and you know, back when I said it's a very risky river bet if the guy doesn't have anything, I was reminded of this tournament I played a couple weeks ago where, you know, I tried to buy a pot on the river with a bet just like this. You know, like a 35 and a 50. It's a bet that makes you think about it.
Right.
But ultimately, you decide that you can afford it. And it's really great if that works. But, you know, it's one of those things where you don't want to bet 50 and make it look too fishy. And then have somebody overcall and win the pot. So it's really tricky, I think. And I think that's exactly, obviously, our opponent here had the goods here, so it didn't really matter. He was trying to get paid off. But that's why I think it's really risky. It's tough when you have nothing and you're out of position to steal that pot. You have to make that perfect bet.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is TournamentButton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo. Ask about the AntiUp logo version and use code AntiUp for free shipping. And this is a slightly interesting one this week, Chris. It comes from Andy Castro, who's written in before. And we're going to play like a Hand of the Week, but there's a little, I don't want to say it's a twist at the end, but a little something we'll discuss at the end.
Okay.
And that might switch it up a little bit. All right, he's out in Vegas. Went up there, took the whole family in the family truckster.
Wow.
And he was at Venetian, one of my favorite places to play out there, playing 1-2 No Limit. And he says he's been playing for about 2 hours, had 350 in front of him. Quite a few calling stations at the table, so it was difficult to raise preflop and not get several callers. This hand, we're on the big blind, and let's see, the under the gun calls, two middle position players call, the button calls, the small blind completes, and we look down at Queen of Spades, 10 of Hearts.
I am going to check.
Sure, why not, right?
Yeah.
In a tournament, this is one of those hands that I might take a flyer on, you know, putting a pretty healthy raise in since everybody limped, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a great hand to do that with, but if how often do you get a big blind hand where a bunch of people lip around? So, you know, if I got a hand that could flop big, I might take a shot. But cash game, there's no reason to.
Yeah.
All right, so that's exactly what we do. The flop is the 10 of clubs, 7 of clubs, deuce of hearts.
Okay.
And it was small blind checks to us.
Well, you know, there's so many people in this hand. And, yeah, we have top pair, but so many hands are going to come along. So do we want to try something unique here, like a check raise if somebody bets? Or do we want to just bet out and say, hey, I'm in the big blind, and I probably got two pair here, and I have a big blind special, and you know, you guys be crazy to come along because I'm just going to keep betting the whole way. I mean, there's a lot of ways that you can attack this hand, I think. I think that I would probably put some sort of bet out here just because there's so many people out there that I want to see what happens when I do that, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There are times where I would check this hand, too, because a lot of limping means pocket sevens. A lot of limping means pocket deuces. A lot of limping means suited aces. I don't know. I feel like maybe a bet here might be required.
I think you can go two ways with this, but I think whichever way you go, you need to commit to playing it that way the rest of the hand.
Yes,
and that's where I think people forget or they switch it up here a little bit. I can totally make a case for betting here, even betting the pot, which is, you know, $12, I think. And just because we got a top pair, you know, it's nothing else. We'll thin the field. I don't harbor any illusions that we're going to take it down here, but we'll thin the field. But then I'm going to have to keep up that aggression. Yeah. And that's tough to do out of position. But if you have the frame of mind to do that, then keep doing it. But I don't think I want to bet here, oh my gosh, I got called. Now I'm going to shut it down. If you're going to do that, forget it.
No, exactly.
If you're going to do that, then I think the proper option is to check here and see what transpires. It's probably not going to be a huge bet for you to call when it comes back to you. So at that point, you need to decide whether you're going to check raise. If you're going to check raise, then I think you're going to go back to the same thing where you're going to have to keep the aggression up the rest of the way. I think more likely if you're going to check here, I'm just going to check call and, you know, obviously hope for another 10 or a queen. Or just kind of play it passively to the end and see if I can get to the showdown fairly cheaply and get somebody that's got, you know, I don't know, ace jack or something that's strong, but they wouldn't have raised beforehand trying to steal it from us.
Yeah, no, I agree. I like the check raise if you do it. You know, you really got to commit to it though. That means you got to come betting, you know, on the next street. You got to bet
not
out.
Strong. You doesn't matter strong. What it is.
That's right. Yeah. So. No matter what happens, you got to really represent that you have two pair or a set or something here. The other thing is that a lot of people will represent a flush draw by check raising this way too. So if the club gets there, now you're screwed because you're representing that you might be representing that you have a club draw, and then someone actually might have the club draw, and then you're screwed. So I think I like betting out here and seeing what the hell's going to happen.
Yeah, and another thing about checking, which I kind of like in this situation, and not check raising, is you can represent the clubs if they come.
Right.
You know, obviously you got to worry about how many other people are in the hand. If there's still three in the hand at that point, somebody else probably has clubs too. But if you know, if your head's up or even three-handed, I might take a shot at representing those clubs if that club comes, and I'd see what happens. It's a little risky, obviously, in a cash game, but you get that option. That option's available to you if you check rather than play it strong here.
Yeah, it worries me when you do something like that if there's a bet and a call and then you just call, because you can't represent the clubs just calling, because then someone else could have the clubs. You know what I mean? That's what makes me worried, too.
So. Oh, yeah, true, true.
You know, how do you represent clubs unless you're putting money out there to show them that you're, you know, if you're just checking, you're not showing them anything.
We don't have our flush yet. But
right, you know what I mean, though. I mean, like, in other
words, if the club comes and we wake up, then everybody's going to, you know, you get that, particularly in a 1-2, you get to those players that just shake their head and they're like, gosh, I knew you'd get there.
Yeah.
And they fold. I love when that happens, when I'm sitting there holding absolutely nothing. And they get all upset, and I know they, like, folded, like, two pair or something like that. And I'm like, ugh! I'm like, yeah, I've got there. If I got there, I mean, I got your chips.
Yeah, I love letting them think that they're right, no matter what it is, no matter what situation it is. They're like, stupid ace, and I'm holding pocket tens, you know? Yeah. I'm like, okay, yep, I had ace-king, you know, so.
But I think it'd be hard for you to represent that if you check-raised or came out betting here.
Yeah, came out betting, I think it's tough. Although, yeah, you know what, let's just move on, because I think we could talk about this for
an
hour.
No, it's a very interesting way to play it, yeah, if you have it. Yeah. And again, that gets down to mixing it up a little bit, so you throw people off. So.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's see. Our hero decides to go for a check raise and was confident the under-the-gun player who was pre-aggressive would try to steal it. Sure enough, under-the-gun bets $6 into the $11 pot. We must have lost a dollar somewhere. Maybe the rake, I guess.
Rake, yeah.
Middle position, let's see, we got a middle position player calls, the button calls, and the small blindfold. So a $6 bet, two calls, gets back to us, and as I said, he already was planning on a check raise, so he raises to 24.
Yeah, that's, I guess that's about right. I mean, it's a cash game, though. You know, I might even bet more than that.
Yeah, I think if you're going to check raise here with that many callers, I think, you know, they really commit to it. I think it's going to be at least 30.
Yeah, at least 30. I was thinking maybe even more, but I was thinking at least 30 on a check raise like that.
You should get a good amount of money in that pot right now. So, I mean, at this stage, you know, so 4, 24, it's 35 in the pot right now. So,
yeah, 35 is a good bet.
And we got top pair, so with the with a not a great kicker, so if I could take it down right there, I'm happy with that.
The other thing, too, is what you're telling people with a check raise. We've talked about this before on the show. When you check raise, you're literally telling everybody in the hand that it didn't even matter that you gave them a free card because that's how strong your hand was, that you were able to check raise. A lot of times you're telling them that because if you did check and let it go to the next street, you weren't even worried about losing them. You know what I mean? You were saying to yourself, my hand's so strong that I can actually check and let them catch up. That's something that you are conveying sometimes with that move. So in this case, when you bet that 35 or whatever, you know, they're going to need, the only way they're going to call is if they have a hand that they think can bust what you currently have. So by check raising here, you're not telling them you have the flush draw. You're telling them that you have a pretty strong hand, and the only thing you're worried about is, you know, maybe somebody getting there on the turn, but the way you've played it doesn't seem like you're worried about anything.
Right.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So, I mean, that's the thing. So now if you're betting pretty big, then, you know, they're going to have to really have a hand that can bust you on the turn. So you have to be wary of that. If they call and the turn comes and it completes clubs, you know, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah. Well, again, we're out of position, so we're always in trouble in that situation. Yeah, even if the clubs don't come and they raise, I mean, it could be a two pair, it could be a set got there. You know, you just never know at that point. You're out of position, so your opponent could play all kinds of things at you.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
All right, so let's see. The other gun player folds. One of the middle position player calls, and the button folds. So we're heads up, and he says our remaining opponent is one of the calling stations that he previously mentioned, who had seen several chase draws to the river. He says a flush draw or straight draw are definitely a big possibility in this case, but I lean more towards the flush draw.
Okay.
Yeah, what was our board again? Oh boy, straight draw is really difficult here.
Yeah,
I guess 8-9 would really be. What you'd have to have some kind of combination there.
Jack 9, right? Because no, what's on the what's on the board?
10 of clubs, 7 of clubs, deuce of hearts. So it could be Jack 9, but that'd be a gut shot.
That'd be gut. Yes.
Well, actually, everything's a gut shot. So
no, 8-9.
No, 8-9 wouldn't. 8-9.
So 8-9's the hand that you're worried about.
Yeah. All right. Well, the turn was the 6 of diamonds.
We were talking about the hand.
Completes the straight if he had the 8-9.
That's right.
Which our hero says, oh, well. I still feel like I need a bet here. So it makes it 45 and then a 73 pot. What do we say about that?
Yeah, well, we talked about being strong and not worrying about the turn. So it seems to me somebody coming along for this is probably the flush draw rather than the straight draw. I mean, 8-9 could be a part of this because of the limps all the way around. That big bet you made, which maybe if it was bigger might have forced out an 8-9, but maybe an 8-9 goes away for that. Maybe not, because they know if they don't hit it on the turn, they're going to be forced out of his hand. But I feel like 8-9 is not this guy's holding. I think that you have to bet here, just like we said. If you're going to check raise, that means you're literally telling them that you have a very, 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 very strong hand and that you weren't afraid of anything. So now on the turn, checking would be like just absolutely preposterous. So you have to bet. And he bet 45 into what? 73?
Just 73, which I think is a little bit much.
It's kind of big.
Here's the thing is, if we get raised here, we have to assume that we're toast, right? We have no backup whatsoever, I don't think. We got, you know, top pair with a weak kicker.
Right.
And it doesn't matter whether we get outplayed here or not. If he's willing to raise here, we got our answer and we're done, I think. So I want to put in as little money in this bet. I need a bet, you're right. But I want to put in as little as I need to figure out that answer. So 20 might be a little light. 25, maybe 25, 30, I think this might be what I put in there.
Yeah, because, you know, generally when we're talking tournament poker, we're thinking two-thirds the pot on the turn or so, maybe half the pot. So half would be about 35, you know, two-thirds would be more. So two-thirds is about 40, 45. So I can see that's why he might have been doing it. But this is a cash game, and we're heads up. And I feel like 30 might be the number, maybe 35. But 45 just seems like a little too much.
Well, think about it. Even if it's 35, you're saving 10 bucks if you get raised here.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's pretty significant in a 1-2 game. That's, you know, three orbits around.
Yeah.
You know, if you put 30 in instead of 35, you know, it's another orbit around. So, you know, I think that stuff makes a difference. And I don't think that it makes a terrible difference, you know, in terms of what our opponent's going to do there, whether we bet 30, 35, 40, or 45 here.
Right.
Could be wrong.
Right. It's just, yeah, it feels like if somebody's drawing to anything, or if they have a decent holding, I feel like 25 or something won't be enough because they already called 24.
Yeah.
You know, so now you're just giving them even better odds than before when they called 24. So if the straight didn't get there and we don't get raised, you know, if this person doesn't raise our bet, then.
I mean, 30 bucks would be a 3-1 call for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So with one card to come.
Yeah. So any less than that, they're getting better odds.
Right.
So I think 35, 30, something like that. 35 is half, so I would probably bet 35. But 45 just seems like too much, like you said. It's like some money you should be saving here.
All right. Well, as we said, we bet 45, and our opponent just calls. I shouldn't say just calls. He says he actually wrote he calls. So he calls. Okay. I'm adding just calls in there. But yeah. I'm surprised that he just calls.
Well, a call is interesting because if he had a straight, you'd think he'd want to protect his hand against the clubs. Because there are people who would play a nut flush draw the way we are playing this hand right now. Some people will say, hey, I'll check, and then try to check raise, take it down, and not have to hit the flush. And then if I don't hit on the turn, I'll represent that I have the flush. Then on the river, if I hit my flush, it's disguised. So people are, you know, tricky this way. So if somebody just calls here, like, well, not just calls. If somebody calls here, right, I don't think that they have a straight. Because I think if they had a straight, they would raise to protect their hand here. I feel like this person now is on a draw themselves.
Well, let me ask you this. We check raised, right?
Mm-hmm.
We flop, and then we bet out on the turn here. I think it's really hard to put us on clubs. I think maybe you were trying to talk me into the fact that we could still have clubs back on our flop on the check raise. But I'm not buying it. I don't think, at this point, if I'm the straight, 8-9, which I think is really well disguised, I can't put our one opponent on club, so I'm not really worried about that club coming. I guess the only reason I'm worried about that club coming on the river is it's going to kill my action.
Mm.
You know, because this guy's probably going to slow down and check, and then I'm going to have to put in some kind of, you know, weak bet and hope that he calls. But that's the only thing I'm really worried about. I'm really not worried as the opponent right now if I have 8-9 about the clubs. So I think you're right. Most people would raise to protect their hand, but I wouldn't necessarily. But yeah, so I mean, I guess back to what is he calling with at this point then? So I guess if you're going with my line of thinking, he could be calling with 8-9, but it was 1-2 game. I don't think players would do that too much. So at this point, he's either overcalling on a flush draw, which is great for us
right
now, or he just doesn't believe us. And if he doesn't believe us, I don't know if he's going to stop believing or all of a sudden believe us on the river.
Well, what
call
kind
is
of,
really dangerous here to me.
To me,
I'd rather the folder raise.
I actually have played flush draws this way before, and where I'm check raising to try to take it down right away, and then if I can't and the turn comes and I don't have it, so if I'm out of position, I have to bet to represent a big hand and try to take it again. And if I can't, hopefully it gets there on the end. If it doesn't, then I have to fire the third barrel, or then I give up.
Right.
I have played it this way, so that's why I keep coming back to that we literally could have clubs because I've played it this way. That's
exactly, it's possible.
So,
and again, so. I think we're both saying on a second level. I mean, the 8-9 is a weird analysis for me, and I mean, I love the way that you play that check raise, because, you know, then if it hits, then
right.
You know, then you could really stack someone. So yeah, I mean, we never, and there's no certainties in poker, right? But I guess what I'm just saying is I think it's I'm a little worried when we get excited that he doesn't have the straight here because he's not raising.
Okay.
I think we need to keep in the back of our mind. At this point, I mean, the worst case scenario is this guy's still calling. Look at the money we put in this pot with top pair weak kicker.
I know.
And that's the real problem for me here. It doesn't really matter what he has now. There's nothing. I got to hope a queen or 10 comes on the river, because I can't imagine betting with anything else.
Yeah.
And I have to shut it down, and he's going to bet, and I can't imagine calling at that point.
It's going to be tough to bet.
I think
river.
We just got really screwed here. And it could have been us, or it could have been a weak opponent that's just, obviously he's been described as a calling station, so you got to take that into effect. But here's the thing, if he's a calling station, he's going to call on the river too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. this is
and brutal. A calling station doesn't mean a bad player. It just means they're just not.
They don't believe you ever.
Very active in you know, in taking the pot. They're just happy to let you, you know, drive the action and set the price for them, and they're fine with it. So I really, at this point, I don't see this player folding on the river.
All right. Well. All right. So we know he bet 45. We know he got called. We know that means that there's 160 in the pot or so. And we're going to the river with just one pair and not that good of a kicker. Okay, I'm excited.
Wait, and we could be dead, too.
And we could be drawn dead. We're excited.
Am I just, oh, man, this sucks. All right, the river's the six of hearts, so the board is finished off with ten of clubs, seven of clubs, deuce of hearts, six of diamonds, six of hearts. So we get a weak two pair there. So here says, I thought I was still ahead here, but I did not feel confident to make enough to make a bet. He says, I know, chicken, shh. No, actually, I think you're being really smart here. I'm not going to bet into this. The six was an interesting card. It helps me a little bit, but not doesn't help me enough to not be chicken shh.
No, I mean, if the two, the deuce was like a bigger card, so it would make sense that somebody could have a smaller two pair or something, you know, then it would be like, oh, okay, well, now I've counterfeited his two pair, so it's a big card for me. But in this case, somebody's not holding seven deuce here, so... yeah, that sixth row doesn't change much for us unless this person was hoping to fill up on their boat, you know, or something. But even that's very – we wouldn't have played – I don't think that person would have played a set this way. So, yeah, I don't think the six changes anything. The problem now is that we've shown some huge strength the whole way. And if we check – this, if this guy just – now, you said he's a calling station. So I don't usually equate calling stations with floaters.
Right, no, exactly. So if we check, it could be checked behind, and we get a free look right there.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And if we check and then he bets, then you have to think the 8-9 is plausible or a set or something.
Or something that's got his beat, right?
Yeah, something's
he's
got
not going to be making
his
bet with 10-9, is he?
You don't think so. I mean, I just don't – I don't see this guy – yeah, I don't see him. Or even Jack-10 still.
Jack-10, you know? Maybe. That'd be really the only hand that I think he could –
he could bet with. And
but
even that,
really, a calling station's going to bet on a board like this on the end?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we could check, and then if he does bet, if it's something that's, you know, hey, I want to see what this guy's doing.
The six is not exciting for us, but I think it does help against a calling station because it scares a calling station if he didn't have any either. So yeah. Let's say he has the Jack-10, which we're talking about. I don't think he's going to be emboldened. I don't think most calling stations are going to be emboldened enough to bet on here if we slow down. I think he's going to see that six as a scare card just like we did.
Yeah.
Even though we checked.
The other thing, too, is if we, you know, if he does think about how we play, we could very well be playing this like a set up until that point because you check raise with a set all the time. People do it all the time. You
sure.
Bet out with a set to protect your hand all the time.
Yep.
And then on the river, now it boats up. You think if you bet, he's going to fold. So you check to hope he's going to try to steal it, and then you call with a boat. That does happen. So that six could scare the straight to just check behind you. So
yeah.
So let's just check and see what happens.
All right. He says we decided that obviously we weren't confident enough to make the bet, so we plan on calling a reasonable bet. So we check. Our opponent immediately pushes all of his chips in the middle, $189.
Wow.
It was more than the approximately 116 the pot.
Okay, wait a minute. So I have to ask, how could this guy, why would this guy shove when we check? I mean, if we were going to call, how much did you say it was, 180?
189.
If we were going to call 189... wouldn't we bet something on the end? I mean, why would they think we would call 189 if they had the best hand? You know what I mean? That's an odd bet. I mean,
well, it's an odd bet, but here's what it forces us to do. And I think a little bit what we're talking about with O'Malley's move is this is the opposite of what I was talking about. You know, if you had nothing and you bet, it's 116 pot and you bet 60 or something. That's the bet that you really are curious about at that point because it seems like a reasonable bet.
Right.
And it might be enough to think that you got it. 189 almost seems like I've got nothing, but I think you're too scared to call my 189.
Yeah.
But if you call it and you're wrong, that's massively terrible, isn't it? I mean, you shoot yourself right there at the table.
Yeah.
And that's why that play works, I guess. As long as you don't have anything, and that's the problem, is I think the calling station has to assume that we have nothing, that we slowed down here, not because we're scared of the six, but just because we've been betting with nothing the entire time, or essentially betting with what we have, that just something that's not too confident. And that's a big gamble. That's a huge gamble on his part.
Yeah, you're only gonna be catching a bluff here. You aren't gonna be catching Jack 10 here, and even that's a bluff, really.
Yeah.
You know, so really, the only hand that I can put somebody on doing this with is a missed flush draw. Because if this person doesn't have the flush draw, and he knows he can't win, but he's put, 45 and 24, so he's put like 70 or 80 into this pot already, and he knows he can't win, but since you showed weakness, he's thinking, if you had anything, you would have bet that river. And when you didn't bet the river, the only way I'm going to win this hand is if I make you not be able to call me and shove. But that's such a hard call to make. It's so much money.
And that's why it works, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a lot of players that will sit there. I mean, I do this all the time. It's probably a weakness, but I'm trying to get bad at it. But I'll sit there and I'll be like, that's a good bet. I think I got you beat, but I'm not going to call $189 here to find out whether I'm right or wrong.
Yeah. God.
And there's other people that will say, hey, that's a ridiculous overbet. He's got to be bluffing, and I'll put it in. And, you know, Godspeed to them. I'm just not to that level now where I'm willing to wager $189. I'll let this guy be the crazy guy, because he really is the crazy guy. Because a lot of players, if they have anything here, are going to call him on that. And if he really has nothing, then he's going to get snapped off so hard.
All right. And, you know, the other thing, too, is you – I'm sure you remember back when we were in the archaic days and we were able to play online poker, the people would, there was always a circulation around of people think, because they heard one person on TV say, why so much? Why so much?
Yeah.
And, well, people were using that against them. They would bet so much with the nuts because they knew that you would think that and then call
exactly.
it. I don't know if that's still
ubiquitous or not. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. So we're flipping a coin here. It's really what we're doing. We're flipping a coin. Yeah. And I don't play poker to flip coins.
Yeah. I have to admit, if I was at the table, I would fold. I just would.
I would have to, and, you know, I'm going to fold the best hand two-thirds of the time there. I guarantee you I am.
Yeah.
And it sucks and it hurts, but it's going to save me more money than that third that I lose out on than if I just call every single day like this. It's a very effective bet if the guy's confident that we can fold it here.
Yeah. Yeah,
and he's got to know that.
If in real life, I think I fold. In this hand of the week, because it's hand of the week, I'm calling. I really feel like this guy, just because of the way we've been talking about it over and over again, I really feel like this guy does not have 8-9, does not have us beat, that he was drawing to the nut flush, or even any flush, like king clubs, you know, something weird, like king 9 of clubs or something, where he had a draw that was sort of a gut shot to a straight by the end, and he also had the second nut flush draw. Something like that where he can get into this hand with a speculative limp and then realize he couldn't win, has too much money invested, which is checking down king high or whatever. So he goes crazy instead because it smells weakness on our part. That's what it feels like to me. So I really think this guy is...
It feels like that to me. I just don't know what that...
Right. No, I know. I'm just saying in the hand where it's not going to hurt me because we're just talking about it.
It's just a virtual hand here.
That's right. It's like play money on PokerStars app. I'm calling because I think he's bluffing. But in real life, put to the test like this, I probably am saying it's just not worth it to call 189 to win 160, of which I only have 80 in the middle, not even. So... You know, I think I am letting this go in real life, but I'm calling now because I think...
Part of it, too, is he could have Jack 10 doing this. I mean, he could have King 10 doing this.
Right.
So even though he's not as strong as we think, he still could be stronger than us.
Yeah, we still could be beat. Yeah, or Ace 10, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
All right, well, I'm real anxious. I want to hear what's going on.
All right, so here's what our hero says. It was what this gentleman did after he pushed his chips forward that made me call. So here's the little part, non-twist I was telling you about.
Oh, okay.
Says he immediately pushed away from the table and crossed his arms and leaned back. He says, I have learned from Joe Navarro that this is an effort to distance himself from his hand because he's not happy with it. The crossing of his arms also tells me that he is guarded. He was also in seat 1 and I was in seat 7 and almost looked like he was hiding behind the dealer. That's how far he pushed away from the table. I called and he said, ace high for the nut flush draw.
Hey.
I took the cards and took the pot. I believe that's the biggest pot I've taken down in my short poker playing career, and he wants to thank Joe Navarro for doing
it. Wow. That's interesting because, you know, it's also the reverse tell thing there. Not reverse, but when they show that they're confident, which is what somebody would do, leaning back, crossing their arms, kind of like, yeah, I'm not worried. There it's reversed. They are worried. You know, that's even part of Caro's tells, too, where, if it's genuine... Then they are strong, and you got to worry about it. But if it looks like this guy was doing everything he could to sell you on it, then it is him trying to hide or him trying to show the opposite of what he's feeling. And that's that takes a lot of guts to make that call, man. Nice job.
Yeah,
that is nice.
And I love the fact that he learned that from Joe from our show and our magazine.
So. Yeah, that's awesome. Way to go, man. That's not an easy call in the heat of this too. That is not easy to do.
You know, and this is one of the easier tells, and I'm not saying I pick up on it all the time, but I'm conscious about this at the table when I do it. I don't move much when I'm in a hand. I will stand. I'm usually always, you know, leaning on the table and forward, and I stay that way through the whole hand. And, you know, this last turn I played, I had all these people trying to stare me down, which I always think is ridiculous. And I just sit there, and I don't move, and occasionally I'll crack a smile, which really pisses them off. And but that's it. And I think part of it is this here, is that the people are reading Joe Navarro, a lot of people do, and hear him, and they're looking for this stuff. And that's not saying that I've concealed all my tells. I'm sure I'm still an open book. But some of these really easy ones are easy to get over. It's not hard to keep yourself from doing what this guy said this guy did, and leaning back and crossing your arms. Those are the easy tells.
Yeah.
It's the other ones that are really harder. So if you just, you know, you don't have to be Chris Ferguson and be completely stoic and the same thing and same amount of time and everything, but, you know, you could do a lot to avoid some of these easy tells being caught.
Yeah, the Navarro perch alone is conceals so much, and you're not doing anything. You're just sitting there.
Exactly.
So, all right, another good show. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.